Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jeff Fort about his book, Williams Gang, A Notorious Slave Trader and His Cargo of Black Convicts, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Dr. Fort is a professor of history at Lamar University. Williams Gang explores the career of prominent slave trader William H. Williams, whose operation was based in Washington, D.C. His infamous Yellow House slave pen was a major stop in the domestic slave trade. Dr. Fort examines Williams' life as a slave trader, and particularly the legal troubles he found himself in when he was accused of trying to sell 27 enslaved convicts from Virginia in Louisiana. The myriad of courtroom battles Williams went through are placed alongside the larger history of slavery and the slave trade in the antebellum period, as Fort explores issues of slave criminality, Southern law, and the U.S. economy. Dr. Fort, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
So to get things started, can you tell our listeners how you came to this topic and why you chose to study it?
I really fell into this topic purely by accident. I was researching a previous book, Slave Against Slave. And that book was about violence within the slave quarters that took place between and among enslaved people. And I was looking at really any sources I could find to document those kinds of conflicts. And I turned for that project as one of my sources to Louisiana State Penitentiary records. And I looked at the Board of Control reports that were published and available for, maybe 15 or so years prior to the Civil War. These Board of Control reports would list the prisoners in the state penitentiary and the crime, therefore. And I wanted to see, I knew that Louisiana was pretty unique in terms of imprisoning enslaved people. So I wanted to see if any enslaved people were there for having committed any crimes upon other enslaved people. And I ended up compiling a database of about 200 or so names in that process. But there was one group of 10 that in particular caught my attention. These were all enslaved people from Virginia. And under the crime column of these reports, it was listed as, quote, Williams Negroes. Of course, I didn't know what that meant. But it didn't really fit with the project I was working on at the time, so I set it aside. Later, I was doing some research in Virginia, at the Library of Virginia, and I came across a microfilm reel. And toward the tail end of this microfilm reel, there was a list of enslaved people who were sold out of the Virginia State Penitentiary in 1840. And I saw the list of names, and they matched the names that I had already seen in Louisiana. And I just kind of wanted to put the two pieces, you know, together. But, you know, I had to finish up the other book first. And so this sat there for a few years. But then I wanted to get back to it so I could put the two pieces of the puzzle together, because I knew there had to be a story there if I had, you know, the same bunch of enslaved people sitting in two different state penitentiaries in 1840. Something was going on. So I wanted to find out what that was. And I was, you know, interested in turning to a different kind of history where, you know, I had a plot. I had not written anything with a plot before. So that was something I wanted to take on.
And so you've already mentioned that, you know, you found these enslaved convicts in the Virginia penitentiary after finding them in the Louisiana one. And you began talking about, you know, these enslaved convicts and how they're, you know, convicted. And then, you know, just there's this whole controversy about what to do with them. And they eventually, the state of Virginia eventually decides to have them sold outside of the state. And so for our listeners, who might be sort of unfamiliar with this topic. Why was it that Virginians seemed so apt, or at least, you know, they seemed a little bit conflicted about, you know, executing enslaved people, with people, which people who don't have as much knowledge on this topic might expect to happen. And instead, they wanted to simply ship them out for sale somewhere else. Why was this happening?
Well, the way that Virginia law functioned at the time, whenever enslaved people would be found guilty for a whole series of crimes, almost by default, the standard punishment was execution. Execution was not reserved for only the most heinous of crimes in the early 19th century. So, of the enslaved people that I'm looking at, about half of them had been accused of nothing more than theft, and the courts that heard their cases put them to death for that. And, you know, certainly the criminal justice systems of Virginia and other slaveholding states, you know, they were not shy about putting enslaved people to death when it served the social function that they wanted it to. You know, in the case of a slave rebellion, for instance, that those public executions sent a very distinct message to slaves who would be witness to that execution, who would hear about those executions, that had the effect of exerting a certain type of racial and social control. But at the same time, if you followed the strict letter of the law, one would be having these executions on a pretty, you know, routine basis. And there are certainly owners of enslaved people who were not terribly pleased, you know, about this prospect. These events are, you know, disruptive in some ways, and you know, that they did like to sort of put some restraints on how the law functioned at its most severe. So even before the law officially allowed sale and transportation, this became sort of a routine thing. What would happen is if a slave was accused of a crime, they would appear in court. There would be typically a panel of five justices, magistrates, in the case of Virginia. And they would hear the case. And if if they decided that the enslaved person was guilty, they would you know, make that ruling. They would then offer a valuation of that convicted slave, saying what that enslaved person was worth at market. In the event that the execution did go forward, that execution would take place, you know, there in the county in which the crime had been committed. But what happens in all these cases in which enslaved people are sentenced to death, the court records are sent to the Virginia governor, and the executive of the state then gets to review the case file, all of the evidence. And it's the governor and the executive council who can decide to reprieve the slave to their sentence to sale and transportation outside the United States of America. Not simply outside of Virginia, but outside of the country. And this is actually done pretty frequently. And initially, in the 19th century, a lot of the enslaved convicts then would be sent to, you know, Spanish Florida. But then, of course, after the United States acquires Florida, they end up getting sent to places like in the British West Indies. Britain emancipates enslaved people in the British Caribbean. So then they end up in the Spanish West Indies. But then they get overrun with these enslaved convicts. They don't really want enslaved convicts from the United States. There's this assumption that these are, you know, bad characters. We don't want this criminal element of the enslaved population in the United States, you know, infecting the enslaved population here in, you know, Cuba or wherever. So as you go forward from, you know, the 1820s into the 1830s and the 1840s, it becomes more difficult to find places that would accept these enslaved convict cargoes. But you do have in Virginia these slave owners who feel that, you know, through sale and transportation, that they are doing something, you know, good for their enslaved people, that this is part of their, you know, paternalistic duty. They're stepping in to spare the life of this bond person by, you know, shipping them somewhere else, that they're looking upon that as, you know, preferable to execution, a more humanitarian way of doing things. And these slave owners, they get paid by the state regardless, whether the enslaved person was executed or shipped out of the country. The owner got paid by the state the value of that slave at market.
And you mentioned that, you know, the other nations are kind of getting inundated over time with U.S. convicted slaves, and they don't like having them for a variety of reasons. And you kind of touched on that very quickly. But as you note, other states south of Virginia as well don't want these convicts either. And this becomes a sort of point of contention for Williams and eventually leads to his legal troubles. And so why were, you know, people in the United States also fearful of having enslaved convicts from another portion of the country?
Right. Well, again, here too, there is this assumption in the states of the Deep South, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi in particular, that just as part of the regular domestic slave trade, that they're getting the refuse, the cast-offs, the enslaved people that, you know, nobody else wants, the worst of the bunch. Now, in this particular case, we're talking about, you know, convicted felons. That makes it, you know, so you have states like Louisiana in 1817, the state legislature passed a law prohibiting the introduction into the state of enslaved convicts from other states. What had happened was that late the previous year, there was a slaveholder from New York who was relocating to Mississippi. And he was journeying up the Mississippi River to head to his new home with his enslaved labor force in tow. He stops on his journey in Louisiana to spend the night, but somehow word got out that he had among his enslaved labor force, he had some enslaved criminals who had been convicted in New York of some various crime. And supposedly, the details in the newspaper are pretty sketchy on this, but supposedly there was, you know, a mob that was forming, that they were going to run this guy off. So he hightails it back onto the boat with his enslaved labor force. They continue on up the river. That's what inspired the legislature the very next month to pass this law in 1817. And nobody ends up being prosecuted under this law until the slave trader that I'm studying, William H. Williams, shows up in New Orleans in 1840.
And so, yeah, let's talk about a little bit more about, you know, Williams. One of the things that you have, you know, a lot of detail about in your book is his slave pen, which is located in Washington, D.C., notoriously called the Yellow House, as you said. And what is the Yellow House? What is it like? And how do you have so much detail about it? What are some of the sources that you're able to draw from that, you know, allow us to actually know so much about, you know, this one place of operation for Williams?
Sure. The Yellow House is the private slave jail that William H. Williams ran in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. It was between 7th and 8th Streets and B Street and Maryland Avenue. It's on today the block that's occupied by the Orville Wright Federal Aviation Administration building. It's across the street from the Hirshhorn Museum. All of this is just south of the mall in Washington, D.C. It's about half a mile, you know, west of the U.S. Capitol. Congressman noted at the time that, you know, they could see the Yellow House from the U.S. Capitol. But we have quite a bit of information on the Yellow House. You have certainly William H. Williams' advertisements in the local paper, advertising his services. Because not only was he a slave trader, but he kept this pen. So, you know, he would keep the enslaved people that he was planning on selling to the South there. But for other slave traders in the Washington, D.C. area who didn't have slave pens of their own, they could keep their enslaved cargoes in his pen as well prior to their departures from be it Alexandria or Baltimore or wherever. So you have all the newspaper data. There are newspaper correspondents. There are traveler's accounts. Frederica Bremer would be in that category, who made a point when they were traveling around, when they were visiting the nation's capital, they would stop by the Yellow House just to visit. They wanted to see what this place looked like, and the people who worked there, the jailer and all that, they were actually rather accommodating in terms of, you know, giving tours to people who showed up, people who said flat out, hey, you know, we're abolitionists, but we'd like to, you know, take a look around. And they're like, well, sure, I'll give you a little guided tour of our facility. So there's a good three or four accounts where we have people talk about, you know, being led around the offices. I mean, I know what's, you know, hanging on the walls there, what the office looks like. You got the big iron gate. You can see the courtyard where the enslaved people could congregate during the day. We got descriptions of their, you know, sleeping quarters. But then you also have one very good slave narrative, slave autobiography from Solomon Northup, the author of, you know, 12 Years a Slave. He, of course, was the free black man from the North who was kidnapped and sold unlawfully into slavery. When his kidnappers take him to Washington, D.C., he is he's drugged, and he wakes up in the basement dungeon of the Yellow House slave jail. He's chained to the floor. He's got a bench there. And then his enslaver, James H. Birch, comes in and flogs him. We get a very good description of the horrors of this slave pen from Solomon Northup as well. And in the movie 12 Years a Slave, there's one scene that kind of captures the Yellow House's proximity to the U.S. Capitol. The scene zooms out from the slave jail, and then you get to the Capitol dome because you're really just, you know, a half mile away.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of detail that you're able to bring to life for the Yellow House in the book is, you know, amazing, considering how many, as you said, how many sources there are for it. And, you know, you're able to kind of really recreate what this place looks like. And as you said, I mean, it was kind of, you know, a very central part of D.C. to the point that, you know, most people were well aware of it. And it's kind of just, it's a little bit crazy to think about in, you know, our own time to think about that, but it was just, it's very commonplace at the time.
Well, and really the Yellow House was a landmark in its day. It was a three-story brick structure, plastered and painted yellow. But, you know, it was there before any of the Smithsonian museums. It was there before, you know, the Link Memorial, the Washington Monument. It's one of the prominent buildings of the era.
And one of the things that you look at as well when it comes to Williams and the kind of larger culture around him is the sort of legal troubles that slave traders usually face, including at times Williams himself. And so what sort of things did slave traders such as Williams have to deal with when it came to, you know, courtroom dramas and everything like that? And by the time that Williams begins his troubles in New Orleans, how did he usually face these troubles?
You know, Williams actually did fairly well in terms of all of the legal hassles that went along with his profession. Slave traders were, you know, pretty routinely involved in breach of warranty suits, or like in Louisiana, where he's selling most of his enslaved cargoes, redhibition suits. When slave traders would make these sales, they would often have these, you know, guarantees that this enslaved person was healthy, was sound, was a good, you know, carpenter or whatever the case happened to be. Williams was remarkably generous. If you look at the bills of sale that he executed in New Orleans,
A lot of these are available at the New Orleans Notarial Archive. He extends very generous terms to his buyers, especially his repeat buyers who had, you know, some of the bigger like sugar plantations in Louisiana. So I mean, he was quite generous with all of that. If anybody came back complaining that, well, this enslaved person wasn't really quite what I wanted, he very readily, you know, exchanged them for another person that he had within his stock. And you know, if the one that they wanted was of a lower value, he'd give them the replacement individual plus, you know, the difference in cash. He was very accommodating in that sense. So, you know, he fares a lot better in terms of these kinds of redemption suits than some of the other traders in New Orleans, like a Theophilus Freeman or a Bernard Kendig. They end up in court for that kind of thing a lot more. Slave traders are often also accused of, you know, slave stealing or kidnapping. Williams avoids that kind of thing too. What he does get charged with pretty frequently is wrongfully imprisoning free black people at the Yellow House in Washington, D.C. And of course, this would have been, you know, terrifying for these individuals, because they're free. They end up being imprisoned in a slave pen. And they know that it's only a matter of time before they end up being sold, you know, to the South as enslaved people. So there's actually quite a few lawsuits available at the National Archives to document these free black people and their struggles to try and get out of the Yellow House. They're filing petitions. They're securing writs of habeas corpus so that they can, you know, appear before a judge and have their case heard expeditiously before it's too late, and they end up, you know, losing their freedom. One of the big players, you know, helping them out is the district attorney in the District of Columbia, a guy by the name of Francis Scott Key, who, you know, he's a much older man by this point, but the guy who, you know, wrote the lyrics to the Star Spangled Banner, he ends up being a prominent attorney in Washington, D.C., and he ends up representing a number of free black people in their effort to try and earn their liberation from the Yellow House.
And when Williams eventually, you know, faces his legal troubles in New Orleans, one of the most interesting things that I found about it, was that his trial became a sort of constitutional issue for the state of Louisiana. You know, just this one person's trial over, you know, wrongfully bringing in enslaved convicts and supposedly trying to sell them, you would think that would just be, you know, his own affair. But as you point out, it becomes this kind of big issue for the state of Louisiana. And so how did this happen?
Well, you know, he ultimately ends up in Louisiana involved in, let me count, like five trials grand total. Related to the importation of this particular cargo of enslaved convicts. And initially, in the first district court, a lot of the issues merely concerned things like intent, because, you know, William H. Williams, when he's arrested for importing these convict slaves, he says that, well, that should not really have happened because he had no intention of selling these enslaved convicts in Louisiana, you know, contrary to that 1817 law. He said he was only passing through Louisiana, that he was going to deliver these enslaved convicts to the foreign country of Texas. This is 1840, so Texas is an independent slaveholding republic. They are eligible to receive these kinds of convict slaves in Texas. So he says he's passing through. He has no intention of violating the law. But the state of Louisiana prosecutes him anyway because they say, well, the intention doesn't matter. It's the importation that is the issue here. And the folks in Louisiana, the attorney general, they're arguing that we have a real, you know, safety issue, that, you know, we need to protect the citizens of Louisiana from this, you know, dangerous enslaved criminal element that you are, you know, introducing into our state. The funny thing about it, though, is that the way the Louisiana state law was structured is that if Williams was found guilty, the state was to seize the enslaved people from him and then sell them. So they would be, you know, purchased and released into the enslaved population of Louisiana anyway. So Williams could counter-argue that and say, well, if you're concerned about safety, give the slaves back to me and I will carry them out of here. So on that basis, these conflicting issues of intention and safety, there's two hung juries initially, there's a third trial. Williams is found guilty. But then we get to the appeal. And this is what raises the more constitutional issues with respect to the state of Louisiana. Because the state had prosecuted Williams criminally. They said that this was a criminal case. But Williams argued that it was actually a civil case. Which he knew because the punishment for it was nothing more than a substantial fine. So this leads to a case appearing before the Louisiana State Supreme Court in 1842. Williams actually ends up, you know, winning this case. The state had said that he shouldn't even be there because at the time, the Constitution of Louisiana did not allow appeals in criminal cases. But the Supreme Court of Louisiana wanted to hear that case and threatened the lower court judge with imprisonment if they didn't forward the case to them. But then the state, got a rehearing of the case on different constitutional grounds, kind of determining how they actually defined what was a civil suit and what was not. So there's another case before the Supreme Court in 1844. It's a colossal mess, a lot of which would have gotten resolved when, you know, Louisiana passes a new state constitution in the mid-1840s. So a lot of this would have been cleared up if it had just happened a couple years later. But as it was, it created a great deal of consternation among the legal scholars in Louisiana.
And one of the things that you just mentioned was, you know, the issue of what to do with the enslaved convicts, and that, you know, Louisiana, by their own logic, doesn't want them, but ends up having to basically take them and then sell them into the state, which is, as you point out, pretty much exactly what happens. And so what sort of experience did these enslaved convicts face in Louisiana?
Okay, well, in 1840, initially, the enslaved people, they're down to like 26 of them by this point. One was sold illegally while still in the Chesapeake. But 26 enslaved people are arrested. And at that point, initially they were all taken to the watch house in New Orleans. From there, it's a little difficult to track them. They get farmed out, from the best I was able to tell, to various different incarceration facilities in Louisiana. But their whole status is in limbo until the 1844 Supreme Court case, the second of the two Supreme Court cases. So, you know, they're basically, you know, incarcerated for these 4 years. And at that point, I think they get kind of redistributed again. And you've got the 10 of them that end up in the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Baton Rouge. Those are the 10 that I had originally, you know, found in the records that inspired the whole thing in the first place. And, you know, when they're in that penitentiary in Baton Rouge, they're still enslaved, but their new master is the state of Louisiana, and they end up working for the state. They're clearing out bayous, they're building roads, they end up, working in, the various, like the brick making, factory that they have there in the prison. They're doing all kinds of different things, along that line. I assume that the, enslaved female convicts, because there were half a dozen women, they would have been doing the cleaning and washing. That the women in the penitentiary did. But they end up just having a different master for a period of many years, ultimately, because Williams, he doesn't give up after the Supreme Court rules against him in 1844. He's basically going to devote the rest of his life trying to get these enslaved convicts back. So all of them, they're just going to be laboring in various incarceration facilities while he's going to continually pursue their return.
And as you just mentioned, Williams, you know, continues to, you know, try and get these people back. And he continues after, you know, going, well, or should say, while doing all this, he continues his slave trading business. And as you point out in the book, mostly from New Orleans, and he leaves, you know, his brother in charge of the Yellow House. And so one of the things that you point out about the Yellow House's presence and, you know, Williams's own continuation in the domestic slave trade is that the Yellow House contributes a lot to national debates about slavery, especially in the nation's capital itself. And so how does that, you know, what does that look like? And how does the Yellow House eventually close? You know, is it Williams just closing up shop or is something else going on?
Of course, the slave trade in Washington, D.C., was a long-term thorn in the side of abolitionists. There are complaints about the slave trade in Washington, D.C., dating back decades by the time my story starts. But the Yellow House does become a real kind of focus of discontent. There's all kinds of complaints about, certainly in the, you know, the 1820s, and early part of the 1830s about, slave coffles, being led through, the streets of Washington, D.C., the slaves, you know, chained two by two, being led down Maryland Avenue across the Long Bridge over the Potomac over to, you know, the waiting ships, in Alexandria, for transport via the coastwise slave trade to the Deep South. Those kinds of images, were a real, you know, stick in the craw of abolitionists and other anti-slavery forces, in Congress. It was a real, disgraceful thing, you know, to see this, you know, on a routine basis. The Yellow House really gets more involved in the politics of the era in the presidential election of 1844. That year, and by this point, Thomas Williams, William H. Williams' younger brother, is in charge of running the Yellow House. Thomas Williams apparently is the one who raises a Polk and Dallas flag in the 1844 presidential campaign season. James Knox Polk was running for president with his running mate George Dallas, and this Polk Dallas flag is flying on a flagpole right above the Yellow House slave jail. And this created quite the controversy in the press in Washington D.C. You have the Democratic newspaper, the Washington Globe, and the Whig paper, the National Intelligencer. They're battling back and forth with their own different interpretations of what this flag means, because the Democratic paper, the Globe. They did not want their nominee, James Polk, associated with the slave trader. So what they said, their argument was that he erected this flag, Williams did, because he was a Whig, and he's raising this Polk Dallas flag to try and smear the Democrats, but it's all this hoax he's trying to perpetrate on the public. The National Intelligencer, the Whig paper, says that, well, maybe this is a much simpler argument, that Williams is flying the Polk Dallas flag because he supports the Polk and Dallas ticket. So there's this big back and forth there, and it gets picked up by newspapers in New York and Boston. So people are reading about this across the country, but because there is, even though slave trading has a certain disreputable aspect to it, individual slave traders were not in reality viewed that way. I mean, they're prominent citizens, they're wealthy citizens. They oftentimes, served in political offices. They were not the social outcasts that they were oftentimes portrayed as being. They're very prominent figures in their communities. But still, this nagging issue of the slave trade in Washington, D.C. Becomes one of those issues that is dealt with in the Compromise of 1850. That Compromise of 1850 abolished the slave trade in Washington, D.C. itself. And now the Yellow House, where William H. Williams, ran his business, was in Washington, D.C., proper. So he was very directly affected by this. He had, the last biggest operation with respect to slave trading in Washington, D.C. So the Compromise of 1850 affected him more directly than any other slave trader. By that point, the formerly Virginia portion of Washington, D.C., of the District of Columbia, had already been retroceded to Virginia. So it's really William H. Williams is the guy who's affected by the Compromise of 1850. He might have relocated across the river to Alexandria had he so chosen, but he opts not to do that. He closes down the Yellow House instead. And it's not too long before the Yellow House is torn down a garden is grown in its location, and there's a guy selling flowers there. But Williams wasn't completely done with the slave trade yet, because he's still going to be pursuing these enslaved convicts that he was forced to surrender back in 1840.
And yeah, so we have, this pretty, gripping tale of, Williams' career as a slave trader. And, our listeners might have noticed that, we weren't going to go into all the details of what's going on, because we want you to become readers and pick up the book yourself. And so once again, you know, we have Jeff Foret's Williams Gang, a notorious slave trader and his cargo of black convicts. So we have this great book in front of us right now. Dr. Foret, what might we expect from you in the future? What might you be working on right now?
Right now, well, the honest answer right now is that I'm converting all of my classes to an online format. But in terms of my research, I'm working on a book called Slave Ships to Freedom. It's an outgrowth of this project. It concerns four domestic slave trading vessels that were conveying enslaved cargoes from Alexandria, Richmond, other places, to points deeper in the South. And in each of these four cases, these ships were either shipwrecked or blown off course to holdings in the British colonial Atlantic. And the British authorities in the Bahamas or Bermuda, as the case may be, these enslaved cargoes in all four cases were liberated by those British officials. And this sets off a whole big debate internationally between the United States and Great Britain as the American owners of the enslaved peoples on board, or the insurers, as the case may be, they sought recompense for those enslaved people that the British had liberated. So there's a lot of diplomatic correspondence back and forth. There's some fireworks in the halls of Congress also, as these owners and insurance companies are trying to get their money back. So that's what I'm working on now. It's basically a story of reparations, although those reparations are being understood in a very pre-Civil War 19th century sense.
Well, that certainly sounds like an interesting piece of work, and I'm sure once that's done, we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, Dr. Foret, thank you very much for coming onto the program today.
Oh, well, thank you. It's my pleasure.